there, and Lovell, and Alan Shepard, a veteran test pilot who had recently been reassigned from Pax River to a staff position in Norfolk, and a few others. What they talked about was not space travel, the future of the galaxy, or even the problems of riding a rocket into Earth orbit. No, they talked about a rather more urgent matter. What this Project Mercury might do to your Navy career. Wally Schirra had a lot of reservations about the thing, and Conrad and everybody else listened. Schirra was farther up the pyramid than anybody else in the room. Alan Shepard had more flight test experience, but he had never been in combat. Schirra, at 35, had an outstanding combat record and was the sort of man who was obviously going places in the Navy. He had graduated from the Naval Academy, and his wife, Jo, was the stepdaughter of Admiral James Holloway, former commander of the Pacific Theater in the Second World War. Wally had been on 90 combat missions in Korea and shot down 2 MiGs. He had been chosen for the initial testing of the Sidewinder air-to-air missile out at China Lake, California. He had tested the F-4H for the Navy at Edwards itself. All this before joining Group 20 to complete his flight test training. Wally was quite popular. He was a stocky fellow with a big, wide-open face who was given to pranks, cosmic winks, fast cars, and all the other ways of maintaining an even strain, to use the Schirra-ism. He was a practical joker of the amiable sort. He would call up and say, "Hey, you got to come over here. You'll never guess what I caught in the woods. A mongoose. I'm not kidding. A mongoose. You got to see this thing." And it would sound so incredible, you'd go over and take a look. Up on a table, Wally would have a box that looked as if it had been converted into a cage, and he'd say, "Here, I'll open the top a little so you can see him. But don't put your hand in, because he'll take it all for you. This baby is vicious." You'd lean down to take a look, and bango! The lid flies open, and this huge gray streak springs toward your face. And, well, my God, veteran aviators would recoil in terror, dive for the deck, and only then realize that the gray streak was some sort of foxtail rig, and the whole thing was a jack-in-the-box, Schirra style. It was a broad joke, strictly speaking, but the delight Wally took in such things came in a wave so big that it swept you along in spite of yourself. A smile about a foot wide would spread over his face, and his cheekbones would well up into a pair of cherub bellies, St. Nicholas style, and an incredible rocking druid laugh would come shaking and rumbling up from his ribcage, and he'd say, "Gotcha!" Schirra's gotchas were famous. Wally was one of those people who didn't mind showing their emotions, happiness, rage, frustration, whatever. But in the air, he was as cool as they made them. His father had been an ace in the First World War, shooting down 5 German planes, and both his father and his mother had done barnstorm stunt flying after the war. For all his cutting up, Wally was absolutely serious about his career, and that was his mood now that this astronaut business confronted them. There were some obvious problems. 1, Project Mercury was a civilian program. 2, NASA had not yet developed the rockets or the capsule to carry it out. 3, it involved no flying, at least not in the sense a pilot used that word. The Mercury capsule was not a ship, but a can. Not only did it involve no flying, there wasn't even a window to look out of. There wasn't even a hatch you could egress from like a man. It would take a crew of swabos with lug wrenches to get you out of the thing. It was a can. Suppose you volunteered and got tied up in the project for 2 or 3 years, and then the whole thing fizzled. That was entirely possible, because this rocket and capsule system was novel and had a lot of Rube Goldberg stuff in it. Any test pilot who had ever been to the Society of Experimental Test Pilots convention, to one of those sessions where they show movies of great ideas that never made it out of the test stage, would know what he meant. The Sea Dart, a 10-ton jet fighter that was supposed to take off and land on water skis. Up on the screen, it kept hopping out of the waves, like a rock skipping across a pond, and the audience roars with laughter. The single-engine plane, with a 25-foot propeller that was propped up on its tail to take off vertically, like a hummingbird. It hangs in the air, suspended at 40 feet, tail down, its engine churning furiously, not realizing that it has turned from an airplane into a cockeyed helicopter, and the audience roars with laughter. In the history of flight, these well-meant farces took place all the time. And where would you be then? You would be 3 years behind in flight test. You would be 3 years off the line in the general jockeying for promotion. You would be giving up whatever brownie points you had built up over the past 4 or 5 years. For somebody like Wally, this was no joke. He was at the point in his career where you really start to climb, or you go off on some ill-advised tangent. He was in line to command his own fighter squadron. That was the route to the top, to admiral rank, for a Navy flyer. They talked for a long time. Someone Shiraz's age had more to lose than Conrad, who was only 28. But as every officer knew, it was never too early to screw up your career in the Navy by getting involved in what was known with some sarcasm as innovative duty. From the beginning, George Lowe and others in the NASA hierarchy had been afraid that the pilots would react in precisely this way. As a result, they were amazed. They had briefed 35 test pilots on Monday, February 2nd. Conrad, Shiraz, Lovell, and Alan Shepard among them, and another 34 the following Monday. And of the total of 69, 56 volunteered to become astronauts. They now had so many volunteers, they didn't even call in the remaining 41 men who fit the profile. Why bother? They already had 56 grossly overqualified volunteers. Not only that, the men seemed so gung-ho about the project, they figured they could get by with 7 astronauts instead of 12. Pete Conrad had ended up volunteering, and so had Jim Lovell. In fact, every man who had been in that room at the motel had volunteered, including Wally Shiraz, who had been the most dubious of all. And why? That was a good question. Despite all the pondering, all the discussions, all the career wrestling, all the toting up of pros and cons, none of them could give you a very clear-cut answer. The matter had not been decided by sheer logic. Somehow, in that briefing, in the inner room at the Pentagon, Silverstein and Lowe had hit every button just right. It was as if they possessed a blueprint of the way the fighter jock was wired. The highest national priority, hazardous undertaking, strictly volunteer. So hazardous that if you don't volunteer, it won't be held against you. And they all had got the signal, subliminally in the solar plexus. They had been presented with a Cold War version of the dangerous mission. One of the maxims that was drilled into all career officers went, never refuse a combat assignment. Moreover, there was the business of the first men to go into space. The first men to go into space. Well, suppose it happened just that way. The rocket aces at Edwards, from their eminence, might be able to look down upon the whole scheme. But within the souls of the rest of the fighter jocks who came to the Pentagon was triggered a motivation that overrode all strictly logical career considerations. I must not get left behind. That feeling was magnified by the public reaction. No sooner had the first group of men been briefed than the news that NASA was looking for Mercury astronauts made its way into the press. From the beginning, the reporters and broadcasters dealt with the subject in tones of awe. It was the awe that one has of an impending, death-defying stunt. The question of whether an astronaut was a pilot or a mere guinea pig never entered into it for a moment, so far as the press was concerned. Are they really looking for somebody to go into space on top of a rocket? That was the question, and the only one that seemed to matter. To almost anyone who had followed NASA's efforts on television, the odds against the successful launch of an American into space seemed absolutely dreadful. For 14 months now, the Eisenhower administration had adopted the strategy of openly publicizing its attempts to catch up with the Russians. And so people were being treated to the sight of the rockets at Cape Canaveral and Wallops Island, Virginia, either blowing up on the launch pad in the most ignominious, if briefly hilarious, fashion, or else heading off on crazy trajectories toward downtown Orlando instead of outer space, in which case they had to be blown up by remote control. Well, not all of them, of course, for the United States has succeeded in putting up some small satellites, mere oranges. As Nikita Khrushchev liked to put it in his cruel, colorful farm boy way, as compared to the 1,000-pound Sputniks the mighty Integral was sending around the Earth, loaded with dogs and other experimental animals. But the only obvious American talent was for blowing up. They had many names, these rockets. Atlas, Navajo, Little Joe, Jupiter. But they all blew up. Conrad, like Sherrod or any other test pilot, did not look at the TV footage in the same light, however. What people were seeing on television were, in fact, ordinary test events. Blown engines were par for the course in testing aircraft prototypes and were inevitable in testing an entirely new propulsion system, such as jet or rocket engines. It had happened in Muroc in testing the engine of the second American jet fighter, the XP-80. Obviously, you didn't send a man up with an engine until it had attained a certain level of reliability. The only thing unusual about the testing of big rocket engines like the Navajo and the Atlas was that so much of it was televised and that these normal test events came across as colossal failures. They were not even radical engines. The rocket engines that had been used in the X-1 project and all of the X projects that followed employed the same basic power plants as the Atlas, the Jupiter, and the other rockets NASA was working with. They used the same fuel, liquid oxygen. The X project rockets inevitably had blown in the testing stage, but it had been made reliable in the end. No rocket pilot had ever had an engine blow up under him in flight, although one, Skip Ziegler, had died when an X-2 had exploded while it was still attached to the B-50 that was supposed to launch it. To pilots who had been through bad strings at Pax River or Edwards, it was hard to see how the risk would be any greater than in testing the Century series of jet fighters. Just think of a beast like the F-102. Or the F-104, or the F-105. When Pete talked to Jane about Project Mercury, she was all for it. If he wanted to volunteer, then he should, by all means, do so. The thought of Pete riding a NASA rocket did not fill her with horror. On the contrary, although she never quite put it this way to Pete, she felt that anything would be better, safer, saner, than for him to continue flying high-performance jet fighters for the Navy. At the very least, astronaut training would take him away from that. As for rocket flights themselves, how could they possibly be any more dangerous than flying every day at Pax River? What rocket pilot's wife had ever been to more funerals than the wives of Group 20? Albuquerque, home of Loveless Clinic, was a dirty, red, sod hut, tortilla highway desert city that was remarkably short on charm, despite the Mexican touch here and there. But career officers were used to dreary real estate. That was what they inhabited in America, especially if they were flyers. No, it was Loveless itself that began to get everybody's back up. Loveless was a fairly new private diagnostic clinic, somewhat like the Mayo Clinic, doing aerospace medical work for the government, among other things. Loveless had been founded by Randy Loveless, W. Randolph Loveless II, who had served along with Crossfield and Flickinger on the Committee of Human Factors in Spaceflight. The chief of the medical staff at Loveless was a recently retired general of the Air Force Medical Corps, Dr. A. H. Schwichtenberg. He was General Schwichtenberg to everybody at Loveless. The operation took itself very seriously. The candidates for astronaut would be given their physical testing here. They would go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton for psychological and stress testing. It was all very hush-hush. Conrad went to Loveless in a group of only six men. once more in their ill-fitting mufti and terrific watches, apparently so that they could blend in with the clinic's civilian patients. They had been warned that the test at Lovelace and Wright-Patterson would be more exacting and strenuous than any they had ever taken. It was not the test per se, however, that made every self-respecting fighter jock early in the game begin to hate Lovelace. Military pilots were veterans of physical examinations. In addition to all the usual components of the complete physical, the Lovelace doctors had devised a series of novel tests involving straps, tubes, hoses, and needles. They would put a strap around your head, clamp some sort of instrument over your eyes, and then stick a hose in your ear and pump cold water into your ear canal. It would make your eyeballs flutter. It was an unpleasant, disorienting sensation, although not painful. If you want to know what it was all about, the Lovelace doctors and technicians in their uncompromising white smocks indicated that you really didn't need to know. And that was that. What really made Conrad feel that something eccentric was going on here, however, was the business of the electrode in the thumb muscle. They brought him into a room and strapped his hand down to a table, palm up. Then they brought out an ugly-looking needle attached to an electrical wire. Conrad didn't like needles in the first place, and this one looked like a monster. They drove the needle into the big muscle at the base of the thumb. It hurt like a bastard. Conrad looked up as if to say, "What the hell is going on?" But they weren't even looking at him. They were looking at the meter. The wire from the needle led to what looked like a doorbell. They pushed the buzzer. Conrad looked down at his hand. His own goddamn hand was balling up into a fist and springing open and balling into a fist and springing open and balling into a fist and springing open and balling into a fist and springing open at an absolutely furious rate, faster than he could have ever made it do on its own. And there seemed to be nothing that he, with his own mind and his own central nervous system, could do to stop his own hand or even slow it down. The Lovelace doctors in their white smocks with their reflectors on their heads were having a hell of a time for themselves. With his hand, they were reading the meter and scribbling away on their clipboards at a jolly rate. Afterward, Conrad said, "What was that for?" A doctor looked up distractedly, as if Conrad were interrupting an important train of thought. "I'm afraid there's no simple way to explain it to you," he said. "There's nothing for you to worry about." It was then that it began to dawn on Conrad, first as a feeling rather than as a fully formed thought. Lab rats. It went on like that. The white smocks gave each of them a test tube and said they wanted a sperm count. "What do you mean?" "Place your sperm in the tube." "How?" "Through ejaculation."
"Just like that?"
"Masturbation is the customary procedure."
"What?"
"The best results seem to be obtained through fantasization, accompanied by masturbation, followed by ejaculation."
"Where, for Christ's sakes?"
"Use the bathroom." A couple of the boys said things such as, "Well, okay, I'll do it if you send a nurse in with me. Help me along if I get stuck." The white smocks looked at them as if they were schoolboys making obscene noises. This got the pilots back up, and a couple of them refused flat out. But by and by, they gave in. And so now you had the ennobling prospect of half a dozen test pilots padding off one by one to the head in their skivvies to jack off for the Lovelace Clinic. Project Mercury and America's battle for the heavens. Sperm counts were supposed to determine the density and motility of the sperm. What this had to do with a man's fitness to fly on top of a rocket or anywhere else was incomprehensible. Conrad began to get the feeling that it wasn't just him and his brother lab rats who didn't know what was going on. He now had the suspicion that the reflector heads didn't know either. They had somehow gotten carte blanche to try out any goddamn thing they could think up, and that was what they were doing, whether there was any logic to it or not. Each candidate was to deliver two stool specimens to the Lovelace Laboratory in Dixie cups, and days were going by, and Conrad had been unable to ingest even one, and the staff kept getting after him about it. Finally, he managed to produce a single bolus, a mean, hard little ball no more than an inch in diameter, and shot through with some kind of seeds, whole seeds, undigested. Then he remembered. The first night in Albuquerque, he had gone to a Mexican restaurant and eaten a lot of jalapeno peppers. They were jalapeno seeds. Even in the turd world, this was a pretty miserable-looking objet. So Conrad tied a red ribbon around the goddamn thing with a bow and all and put it in the Dixie cup and delivered it to the lab. Curious about the ribbons that flopped out over the lip of the cup, the technicians all peered in. Conrad broke into his full cackle of mirth, much the way Wally might have. No one was swept up in the joke, however. The loveless staffers looked at the beribboned bolus, and then they looked at Conrad, as if he were a bug on the windshield of the pace car of medical progress. One of the tests at Loveless was an examination of the prostate gland. There was nothing exotic about this, of course. It was a standard part of the complete physical for men. The doctor puts a rubber sleeve on a finger and slips the finger up the subject's rectum and presses the prostate, looking for signs of swelling, infection, and so on. But several men in Conrad's group had come back from the prostate examination gasping with pain and calling the doctor a sadistic little pervert and worse. He had prodded the prostate with such a force a couple of them had passed blood. Conrad goes into the room, and sure enough, the man reams him so hard the pain brings him to his knees. What the hell? Conrad comes up swinging, but an orderly, a huge monster, immediately grabs him, and Conrad can't move. The doctor looks at him blankly, as if he's a vet, and Conrad's a barking dog. The probings of the bowels seem to be endless. Full proctosigmoidoscope examinations. The works. These things were never pleasant. In fact, they were a bit humiliating, involving, as they did, various things being shoved up your tail. The Loveless clinic specialty seemed to be the exacting of maximum indignity from each procedure. The pilots had never run into anything like this before. Not only that, before each remount, you had to report to the clinic at 7 o'clock in the morning and give yourself an enema. Up yours. Seemed to be the motto of the Loveless clinic. And they even made you do it to yourself. So Conrad reports at 7 one morning and gives himself the enema. He's supposed to undergo a lower gastrointestinal tract examination that morning. In the so-called lower GI examination, barium is pumped into the subject's bowels. Then a little hose with a balloon on the end of it is inserted in the rectum. And the balloon is inflated, blocking the canal to keep the barium from forcing its way out before the radiologist can complete his examination. After the examination, like everyone who has been through the procedure, Conrad now feels as if there are 85 pounds of barium in his intestines and they are about to explode. The smocks inform him that there is no John on this floor. He's supposed to pick up the tube that is coming out of his rectum and follow an orderly who will lead him to a John two floors below. On the tube, there is a clamp, and he can release the clamp, deflating the balloon at the proper time. It's unbelievable. To try to walk with this explosive load sloshing about in your pelvic saddle is agony. Nevertheless, Conrad picks up the tube and follows the orderly. Conrad has on only the standard bed patient's tunic, the angel robe. Open up in the back. The tube leading out of his tail to the balloon gizmo is so short that he has to hunch over to about 2 feet off the floor to carry it in front of him. His tail is now, as the saying goes, flapping in the breeze with a tube coming out of it. The orderly has on red cowboy boots. Conrad is intensely aware of that fact because he is now hunched over so far that his eyes hit the orderly at about calf level. He is hunched over with his tail in the breeze, scuttling like a crab after a pair of red cowboy boots. Out into the corridor they go, an ordinary public corridor, the full moon hunchback in the red cowboy boots, amid men, women, children, nurses, nuns, the lot. Red cowboy boots are beginning to trot along like mad. The orderly is no fool. He's been through this before. He's been through the whole disaster. He's seen the explosions. Time is of the essence. There's a hunchback stick of dynamite behind him. To Conrad, it becomes more incredible every step of the way. They actually have to go down an elevator full of sane people and do their crazy tango through another public hallway, agog with normal human beings, before finally reaching the goddamn John. Later that day, Conrad received once more instructions to report to the clinic at 7 the next morning to give himself an enema. The next thing the people in the administrative office of the clinic knew, a small but enraged young man was storming into the office of General Schwichtenberg himself, waving a great flaccid flamingo pink enema bag and hose like some sort of obese whip. As he waved it, it gurgled. The enema bag came slamming down on the general's desk. It landed with a tremendous plop and then began gurgling and sighing. "General Schwichtenberg," said Conrad, "you're looking at a man who has given himself his last enema. If you want enemas from me, from now on you can come get them yourself. You can take this bag and give it to a nurse and send her over, just you, and let her do the honors. I've given myself my last enema. Either things shape up around here or I ship out." The general stared at the great flamingo bag which lay there heaving and wheezing on his desk, and then he stared at Conrad. The general seemed appalled. All the same, it wouldn't do anybody any good, least of all the Loveless Clinic, if one of the candidates pulled out, firing broadsides at the operation. The general started trying to mollify this vision of enema rage. "Now, Lieutenant," he said, "I know this hasn't been pleasant. This is probably the toughest examination you'll ever have to go through in your life, but as you know, it's for a project of utmost importance. The project needs men like yourself. You have a compact build, and every pound saved in Project Mercury can be critical." And so forth and so on. He kept spraying Conrad's fire. "All the same, General, I've given myself my last enema." Word of the enema bag showdown spread rapidly among the other candidates, and they were delighted to hear about it. Practically all of them had wanted to do something of the sort. It wasn't just the testing procedures were unpleasant. The entire atmosphere of the testing constituted an affront. There was something decidedly out of joint about it. Pilots and doctors were natural enemies, of course, at least as pilots saw it. The flight surgeon was pretty much kept in his place in the service. His only real purpose was to tend to pilots and keep them flying. He was an attendant to the pilots' vital stuff. In fact, flight surgeons were encouraged to fly backseat with fighter pilots from time to time so as to understand what stresses and righteous stuff the job entailed. Regardless of how much he thought of himself, no flight surgeon dared position himself above the pilots in his squadron in the way he conducted himself before them, i.e., it was hard for him to be a consummate panjandrum the way the typical civilian doctor was. But at Loveless, in the testing for Project Mercury, the natural order was turned upside down. These people not only did not treat them as righteous pilots, they did not treat them as pilots of any sort. They never even alluded to the fact that they were pilots. An irksome thought was beginning to intrude. In the competition for astronaut, the kind of stuff you were made of as a pilot didn't count for a goddamn thing. They were looking for a certain type of animal who registered bingo on the meter. You wouldn't win this competition in the air. If you won it, it would be right here, on the examination table in the land of the rubber tubes. Yes, the boys were delighted when Conrad finally told off General Schwichtenberg. "Attaboy, Pete." At the same time, They were quite content to let the credit for the lab rat revolt fall to Conrad and to him alone. At Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where they went for the psychological and stress testing, the air of secrecy was even more pronounced than at Loveless. At Wright-Patterson, they went through the testing in groups of eight. They were billeted off to themselves at the BOC, the Bachelor Officers' Quarters. If they had to call for anything on the base, they were not to refer to themselves by name. Instead, each of them had a number. Conrad was number 7. If he needed a car to take him from one place to another to keep the appointment, he was supposed to ring up the carpool and say, "Only, this is number 7. I need a car." The testing, on the other hand, seemed, at first, more like what a self-respecting fighter jock might expect. They gave the candidate an oxygen mask and partial pressure suit and put him in an air pressure chamber and reduced the pressure until an altitude of 65,000 feet was simulated. It made one feel as if his entire body were being squeezed by thongs and he had to force his breath out in order to bring new oxygen into his lungs. Part of the stress was in the fact that they didn't tell him how long he had to stay there. They put each man in a small pitch-black windowless soundproofed room, a sensory deprivation chamber, and locked the door without telling him how long he would have to stay there. It turned out to be 3 hours. They strapped each man into a huge human milkshake apparatus that vibrated the body at tremendous amplitudes and bombarded it with high-energy sound, some of it at excruciating frequencies. They put each man at the console of a machine called the Idiot Box. It was like a simulator or a trainer. There were 14 different signals that the candidate was supposed to respond to in different ways by pressing buttons or throwing switches. But the lights began lighting up so fast, no human could possibly keep up with them. This appeared to be not only a test of reaction times, but of perseverance or ability to cope with frustration. No, there was nothing wrong with tests of this sort. Nevertheless, the atmosphere around them was a bit off. Psychiatrists were running the show at Wright-Patterson. Every inch of the way, there were psychiatrists and psychologists standing over you, taking notes and giving you little jot'em and dot'em tests. Before they put you in the human milkshake, some functionary in a white smock would present you with a series of numbered dots on a piece of paper on a clipboard, and you were supposed to take a pencil and connect the dots so that the numbers beside them added up to certain sums. Then when you got out of the machine, the white smock character would give you the same test again, presumably to see if the physical experience had impaired your ability to calculate. And that was all right, too. But they also had people staring at the candidate the whole time and taking notes. They took notes in little spiral notebooks. Every gesture you made, every tick, twitch, smile, stare, frown, every time you rubbed your nose, there was some white smock standing by, jotting it down in a notebook. One of the most assiduous of the monitors was a psychologist, a woman named Dr. Gladys J. Loring, as Conrad could tell from the nameplate on her smock. Gladys J. Loring was beginning to annoy him intensely. Every time he turned around, she seemed to be standing there, staring at him, without a word, staring at him with utter white smock detachment as if he were a frog, a rabbit, a rat, a gerbil, a guinea pig, or some other lab animal. Scribbling furiously in her notebook. For days she had been watching him, and they had never even been introduced. One day, Conrad suddenly looked her straight in the eye and said, "Gladys, what are you writing in your notebook?" Dr. Gladys J. Loring looked at him as if he were a flatworm. All she did was make another notation of the specimen's behavior in her notebook. To fighter jocks, it was bad enough to have doctors of any sort as your final judges. To find psychologist and psychiatrist positioned above you in this manner was irritating in the extreme. Military pilots, almost to a man, perceived psychiatry as a pseudoscience. They regarded the military psychiatrist as the modern and unusually bat-brained version of the chaplain. but the shrink could be dealt with. You just turned on the charm, lit up the halo of the right stuff, and did some prudent lying. In the interviews for this job of astronaut, as in other situations, the psychiatrist would get on the subject of the hazards of the assignment, the unknowns, though potentially high risk, and then gauge the candidate's reaction. As all heads-up pilots knew, this called for second convolution thinking. It was a mistake to say anything along the lines of, "Oh, I rather enjoy risk. I enjoy hanging my hide out over the edge day in and day out, for that is what makes me superior to other men." The psychiatrist always interpreted that as a reckless love of danger, an irrational impulse associated with the late Freudian concept of the death wish. The proper response, heard more than once during that week at Wright-Patterson, was to say, "Oh, I don't regard Project Mercury as a particularly high-risk proposition. Certainly not compared to the routine test work I've been doing for the Air Force, the Navy, the Marines. Since this project has a high national priority, I'm sure that the safety precautions will be far more thorough and reliable than they were on something like the F-100F, F-102, F-104, F-4B, when I had that one in the test stage." Very slight smile and roll of the eyeballs. Beautiful stuff. This showed that you were a rational test pilot, as concerned about safety as any sensible professional, while at the same time getting across the idea that you had been routinely risking your life and were so used to it, had such righteous stuff that riding a rocket seemed like a vacation by comparison. That created the halo effect. Offhand allusions to daring do would have the psychiatrist looking at you with big white eyes, like little boys. Conrad knew all this as well as the rest of them. He knew exactly how the prudent officer should deal with these people. It was hard not to know. Every night the boys got together in the bock and regaled each other with stories of how they had lined their heads off or otherwise diligently subverted the inquiries of the shrinks. Conrad's problem was that somewhere along the way, the hickory kid always took over and had to add a wink or two for good measure. In one test, the interviewer gave each candidate a blank sheet of paper and asked him to study it and describe what he saw in it. There was no one right response in this sort of test because it was designed to force the candidate to free associate in order to see where his mind wandered. The test-wise pilot knew that the main thing was to stay on dry land and not go swimming. As they described with some relish later on in the bock, quite a few studied the sheet of paper and then looked the interviewer in the eye and said, "All I see is a blank sheet of paper." This was not a correct answer, since the shrinks probably made a note of inhibited imaginative capacity, or some goddamn thing, but neither did it get you in trouble. One man said, "I see a field of snow." Well, you might get away with that, as long as you didn't go any further. As long as you did not thereupon start ruminating about freezing to death, or getting lost in the snow, or running into bears, or something of that sort. But Conrad, well, the man is sitting across the table from Conrad and gives him the sheet of paper and asks him to study it and tell him what he sees. Conrad stares at the paper and then looks up at the man and says in a wary tone, as if he fears a trick, "But it's upside down." This so startles the man, he actually leans across the table and looks at this absolutely blank sheet of paper to see if it's true. And only after he is draped across the table does he realize that he has been had. He looks at Conrad and smiles a smile of about 33 degrees Fahrenheit. This was not the way to produce the halo effect. In another test, they showed the candidates pictures of people in various situations and asked them to make up stories about them. One of the pictures they showed Conrad was a piece of American scene oaky realism, apparently from the Depression years. You could see a poor, sunken, hookwormy sharecropper in bib overalls trying to push a rusty plow through some eroded ground that was more gully than topsoil, aided by a mule with all his ribs showing, while off to one side, the man's sallow, hollow-socketed, pellagra-ravaged wife with a swollen 8-month belly covered by a dress made from a fertilizer sack leans up against their shack to catch her breath, or else to prop up the side wall. Conrad looks at the piece of paper and says, "Well, you can tell that this man is a nature lover. He not only tills the soil, he appreciates the scenery, as you can tell by the way he's looking off toward the mountains, the better to observe the way the pale blue of the range in the distance harmonizes with the purple haze of the hills near his beloved homestead." And on in this fashion, until at long last it dawns on the interviewer that this wiry wiseacre who chatters away with a gap between his front teeth is sending him up, him and his whole test. This did not create the halo effect either. Old Conrad was rolling now. He was beginning to have a good time. But he had one piece of unfinished business. That night, he called up the carpool.
"This is number 7, he said. "Number 7 needs a car to go to the PX.
The next day, after the heat chamber test, in which he spent 3 hours shut up in a cubicle heated to 130 degrees, Conrad was rubbing the sweat off the end of his nose when he looked up. And sure enough, Dr. Gladys J. Loring was right there, making note of the event in her spiral notebook with a ballpoint pen. Conrad reached into the pocket of his pants and came up with a spiral notebook and a ballpoint pen just like hers. "Gladys," he said. She looked up. She was startled. Conrad started scribbling in his notebook and then looked at her again.
"Aha! You touched your ear, Gladys. We call that inhibition of the exhibitionism."
More scribbling in the notebook. Oh, lowering of the eyes, Gladys. Repressed hypertrophy of the latency. I'm sorry, but it has to go in the report. Word of how the flatworm term, how the lab rat had risen up, how Pavlov's dog rang Pavlov's bell and took notes on it. Oh, word of all this circulated quickly, too, and everyone from number 1 to number 8 was quite delighted. There was no indication, however, then or later, that Dr. Gladys Loring was amused in the slightest. When Scott Carpenter called home to California from Wright-Patterson in the evenings, and he was always careful to take advantage of the lower evening rates, his wife, Renee, was usually in the living room. They had a house in Garden Grove, a town near Disneyland. The focal point of the living room was a 3-piece sectional sofa that had a great teardrop-shaped monkey pod coffee table in front of it, and a monkey pod end table at this end, and another monkey pod end table at the other end. A great deal was summed up by those 3 great showy slabs of monkey pod wood, with the yellow-brown grain streaks curling this way and that. Every officer and his wife in the U.S. Navy in the year 1959 understood the monkey pod life. Scott was a lieutenant, which meant that his pay, including subsistence and housing allowance, was only about $7,200 a year, plus some extra flight pay. Young officers and their wives realized from the outset, of course, that abysmal pay was one of the realities of a service career. There were other forms of compensation, the opportunity to fly, which Scott loved, the status of a naval officer, the community of the squadron, when one was in the mood for it, a certain sense of mission, if you were feeling good about yourself, that civilians lacked, extras such as flight pay and a housing allowance and the goodies. Given the dreadfully low pay, the goodies, which were usually trivial by ordinary standards, tended to take on an overblown importance. That was why so many young military couples in the late 1950s had living rooms dominated, ruled, oppressed, enslaved by the most bizarre furniture imaginable. Chinese Kong tables with entire village scenes carved into the tops of them in deep relief. Squads of high-backed Turkish chairs that could have swallowed a ballroom. Korean divans with wood frames so ornately inlaid with mother-of-pearl that the entire room seemed to be grinning hideously. Spanish armoires, so gross, so gloomy, so overbearing that the mere sight of them brought conversation to a halt. And the flamboyant monkey pod. For one of the goodies was the opportunity to buy hand-carved wooden furniture cheaply when you were assigned to the far ends of the earth. That was your opportunity to furnish the living room at last, and the military would ship it back to the States free of charge. Of course, your choice was limited by the local taste. In Korea, you settled for mother-of-pearl or Chinese Baroque, and in Hawaii, where Scott and Renee had been assigned, there was always the monkey pod.
In a department store in Hawaii, a first-rate finished monkey pod coffee table cost about $150, a modest sum, one might say. But if your base pay was only $7,200 a year, that meant you had only 48 such sums to last you for an entire year. And Scott and Renee had four children. But unfinished slabs of this amazing wood with its flaming yellow grain were available for as little as $9. If you were willing to spend 24 hours sanding, rubbing, oiling, and polishing them, and then another 10 or 20 constructing legs or frames, you could save $140. Fortunately, Renee had a good sense of design and was even able to use the monkey pod with finesse, a rare accomplishment in the monkey pod life. Both Scott and Renee had been brought up in Boulder, Colorado. Scott was top drawer by Boulder social standards, such as they were. He was descended from the first white settlers in the state. His mother's father, Victor Knoxon, owned and edited a newspaper, the Boulder Miner Journal. Scott's parents had separated when he was only three, and his mother contracted tuberculosis and was confined to a sanitarium for long stretches, so that Scott lived in Victor Knoxon's house and was, as it turned out, raised by him. Renee met Scott at the University of Colorado and dropped out in her sophomore year to marry him. They spent practically the entire first year on the ski slopes. They were an extraordinarily good-looking couple, both blonde, trim, athletic, high-spirited, outgoing, the sort of couple you seldom actually saw outside the Lucky Strike ads. Many wives of fighter pilots would end up looking on helplessly as their husbands grew more and more distant, a fact they would acknowledge in what were meant as light-hearted remarks such as, "I'm only his mistress. He's married to an airplane." Often, she would be overstating their intimacy. The actual mistress would be someone she didn't know about. Scott, on the contrary, was completely devoted to Renee and their two sons and two daughters. Many nights during the testing for Project Mercury, Scott wrote Renee long letters, some of them 10 or 15 pages, rather than run up more telephone bills. He kept trying to reassure her that he wasn't getting involved in anything reckless. One night he wrote, "Most of all, don't worry. You know what is upmost in my mind and that I wouldn't needlessly jeopardize what we have together." He was determined, he said, to live long enough to make love to you as a grandmother. All along, his feelings on this score had been so profound that he had done an extraordinary thing 8 years before. After finishing his basic flight training at Pensacola and his advanced training at Corpus Christi, he had voluntarily chosen to fly multi-engine PBY-4 patrol planes rather than fighter planes. He didn't even like PBY-4s. He could barely stand to fly them. Who could? They were big, slow, awkward trucks. Yet he had stepped down off the Great Ziggurat Pyramid here at the first major plateau. If the subject ever came up, he would say, "I did it out of allegiance to my family," meaning patrol planes didn't leave as many widows behind. The Korean War was just beginning, and Scott ended up flying P-2V patrol planes up and down the Pacific mainland. Naturally, this was completely outside the big league for Navy pilots in the war. Any truly righteous aviator wanted to be assigned on loan to an Air Force fighter squadron for aerial combat over North Korea. But reconnaissance had its own hazards and trials, and Scott was considered extremely proficient at it. So much that after the war, he was brought to Patuxent River and trained as a test pilot. Nevertheless, Scott had forsaken the righteous competition of his own accord, out of allegiance to his family. Perhaps it had to do with his memories of how his own family had been disrupted during his early childhood.
Well, that was something for a psychiatrist to speculate about, and no doubt they were doing so. In his first psychiatric interview at Wright-Patterson, Scott himself had opened the session. He asked the first question. He said to the man, "How many children do you have?" "I have four." Scott was surprised when he found himself among the 32 finalists in the competition for astronaut. He had bowed out of the big league competition long ago. He had only 200 hours of flying time in jets, and most of that he had accumulated in the course of flight test training. The other candidates all seemed to have 1,500 to 2,500. Yet, here he was. Not only that, as the days had gone by, first at Loveless and now at Wright-Patt, his prospects had begun to look promising. It was amazing. One thing Scott had going for him was his superb physical condition, although at the outset he would have never believed that sheer physical condition could be any vital importance. He had been a gymnast at the University of Colorado and had terrific shoulders with the deltoid muscles bulging out in high relief, a thick, strong neck, an absolutely lean and perfectly formed chest, like a South Sea pearl diver's. And in fact, he had done a great deal of scuba diving, and his torso tapered down like Captain America's in the comic strip. Others complained the whole time, but the test at Loveless and Wright-Patterson didn't bother Scott the slightest. Each one was a moment of triumph for him. One night Scott called, and Renee could tell he was exceptionally pleased over how things were going. It seemed that there was a test of lung capacity. The candidates sat at a table and blew into a tube. The tube led into an instrument with a column of mercury. The idea was to see how long you could hold the column of mercury up to a designated level with the pressure of your breath. The record, they were informed, was 91 seconds. Scott, as he excitedly told Renee that night, knew from years of undersea swimming that after your lungs feel completely out of air and every signal in your central nervous system predicts disaster, if you hold your breath an instant longer, you actually have a substantial reserve supply of oxygen in your system. It is the buildup of carbon dioxide in the lungs, not the absolute depletion of oxygen, that signals the emergency. Scott forced himself to hold his breath through all the early signals while he counted slowly to 100 with the idea of surpassing the mark of 91 seconds. He counted very slowly, as it turned out, and held the column of mercury up for 171 seconds, almost doubling the record. Another candidate in Scott's group also broke the old record by holding the mercury up 150 seconds. He was a Marine pilot named John Glenn. Scott had known Glenn slightly when both were at Pax River during Scott's flight test training. Glenn had set a cross-country speed record, Los Angeles to New York, of 3 hours and 23 minutes in an F-8U fighter plane in July 1957. The two of them had hit it off immediately at Wright-Patt, partly, perhaps, because they appeared to be the two pace-setters in the testing. Scott had broken 5 records in all, and Glenn was usually his runner-up. One day they overheard one of the doctors saying to another, "Let's call Washington and tell them about these two guys." Dr. Gladys J. Loring and the others were astounded by Scott's performance, and not merely by such matters as his lung capacity either. For many of the tests were not physical tests in the ordinary sense, but rather test of perseverance and one's willingness to push oneself beyond the usual limits of human endurance. Scott Carpenter did not mind the note-taking of Dr. Gladys J. Loring in the slightest. Scribble away. Scott was in his element. Conrad was back home in Northdown Creek, back at Pax River, when the letter from NASA arrived. He knew he had not played it very smoothly during the testing. He had compared notes with Wally Schirra, and it turned out that when Wally's group had gone through Loveless, they had been just as ticked off at the way the place was run as Conrad and his group had been. Wally had even led his own little rebellion when they wanted their goddamn stool samples. One afternoon, they had told Wally and the boys to avoid all highly seasoned food that evening, because they wanted to take stool samples the next day. So the whole group headed off to the Mexican section of Albuquerque, and they had picked out the rankest-looking restaurant they could find and fired up their innards with every red mad dish they had ever heard of and hosed it down with plenty of good, cheap, rank Mexican beer. The jalapeno peppers had even gotten into the act. One of the boys had discovered a bowl of jalapeno pepper sauce on the table, a fiery reddish-brown concoction, and had poured it into a Dixie cup and presented it to the lab technicians as if he had a ferocious case of diarrhea, and had laughed his head off when the first sultry cloud of jalapeno aroma nearly wiped them out. But that was as far as he went, the lab technician level. He let the good General Schwichtenberg remain reserved and serene. That was the way Wally himself would have done it. He always knew where the outside of the envelope was, even when it came to pranks. No, Conrad knew he had poked a few unfortunate holes in the old envelope. Still, he had spoken his mind before, and it had never hurt him. His career in the Navy had gone up on a steady curve. He had never been left behind. So he opened the letter. From the very first line, he knew the rest. The letter noted that he had been among the finalists in the selection process and said he was to be commended for that. Alas, it went on. He had not been one of the seven chosen for the assignment, but NASA and one and all were grateful to him for volunteering and so forth and so on. Well, there it was, your classic Dear John letter. Even though in his detached moments he realized that he had perhaps screwed the pooch here and there, it was hard to believe. He had been left behind. This was something that had never happened to him in the nearly 6 years he had been moving up the great invisible ziggurat. A couple of days later, he found out that Wally had made it. Wally was one of the seven. So was Alan Shepard, who had also been in that room at the Marriott. Well, what the hell? Wally himself had given them all a lot of pretty sound reasons why a man shouldn't feel too goddamn unlucky if he didn't get involved in this Rube Goldberg capsule business. It was probably all for the best. Project Mercury was a civilian enterprise and slightly wacky when you got right down to it. They hadn't even chosen pilots, for Christ's sakes. Jim Lovell had been ranked number one in Group 20 at Pax River, and he hadn't been chosen either. They had all been lab rats from beginning to end. It was a good thing someone had set the record straight. Still, it was incredible. He had been left behind. Not too long afterward, Conrad was told that across the master sheet on top of his file at Wright-Patterson had been written, "Not suitable for long-duration flight." Chapter 5. In single combat. They bubble, they boil, they steam and scream, they rumble and they boil some more in the most excited way. This sound of boiling voices was exactly like the sound an actor hears backstage before the curtain goes up on a play that everyone, tout le monde, must attend. Once there, everyone starts chattering away out of the sheer excitement of being there at all, of being where things are happening until everybody's beaming face is boiling away with words and grins and laughs that burst out whether or not anything the least bit funny has been said. As he was not much of an actor, however, this was the sort of sound that terrified Gus Grissom. He was only moments away from the part he was likely to be worst at, and these people were all waiting on the other side of the curtain. At 2 p.m., the curtain was pulled back, and he had to walk onto the stage. A sheet of light hit Gus and the others, and the boiling voices dropped down to a rumble or a buzz, and then you could make them out. There appeared to be hundreds of them, packed in shank to flank, sitting, standing, squatting. Some of them were up on a ladder that was propped against the wall under one of those huge lights. Some of them had cameras with the most protuberant lenses, and they had a way of squatting and crawling at the same time, like the hunkered-down beggars you saw all over the Far East. The lights were on for television crews. This building was the Dolly Madison House at the northeast corner of Lafayette Square, just a few hundred yards from the White House. It had been converted into NASA's Washington headquarters, and this room was the ballroom, which they used for press conferences, and it was not nearly big enough for all these people. The little beggar figures were crawling all over it. The NASA people steered Gus and the other six to seats at a long table on the stage. The table had a felt cloth over it. They put Gus in a seat at the middle of the table, and sticking up over the felt right in front of him was the needle nose of a miniature escape tower on top of a model of the Mercury capsule mounted on an Atlas rocket. The model was evidently propped up against the other side of the table so that the press could see it. A man from NASA named Walter Bonney got up, a man with a jolly-sounding voice, and he said,